Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with the mother-daughter writing duo of Rory O'Neill Schmidt and Rosary O'Neill. Their new book is Kate Chopin in New Orleans. It is a great pleasure to welcome the mother-daughter writing duo of Rory O'Neill Schmidt and Rosary O'Neill, whose new book is Kate Chopin in New Orleans. Rosary has published 19 plays.
That's correct.
Gosh. Mm-hmm. Is the founder of Southern Rep, the first repertory theater in New Orleans, and a professor emerita at Loyola University, New Orleans. Rory O'Neill Schmidt is a filmmaker, photographer, and author who manages faculty development at the University of Southern California, Bovard College. The two have previously collaborated on books about Edgar Degas and voodoo in New Orleans, and now Kate Chopin, our beloved author. So welcome, Rosary.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
And Rory, to have you here in person is really a treat.
I am thrilled to be here. Thank you so much for having us.
Now, this is the perfect time for a book about Kate Chopin, the 125th anniversary of the Awakening. So talk a little bit about choosing her as a subject and thinking about this book and why you think it's lasted so long.
Well, we had originally written a book about Edgar Degas in New Orleans, and there was some story about that maybe they were friends. I have always had an interest in writing about artists, especially artists who are from New Orleans, because I feel like this is such a succulent place to create. In any case, we began to talk about what would it be like to actually be a woman at the same time as Edgar Degas and be a gifted painter, writer, etc. And we discovered, of course, Kate Chopin, and then began the sort of introduction into her life.
Part of the research for Edgar Degas, you know, when he came to Louisiana, he was living at his brother's uncle's home. He was surrounded by his cousins, his nieces, and all these women around him. And we were looking for that book through the lens of a bachelor, a Parisian bachelor artist, and what it must have been like for him, a man who's solitary, who just focuses on his art all day, to be surrounded a home full of women and children, and also some of the dire circumstances they'd lived through, childbirth, cholera, yellow fever, malaria being rampant at that time in the 1870s. And so we got to flip it, and we got to actually almost kind of become one of his sisters-in-law or cousins and kind of experience those fears that Kate Chopin must have had being pregnant 6 times.
Right.
Each time, you know, and just the terror and the possibility of her death or her child's death.
I think also because there was so much scandal involved with her life. I mean, a good heroine, a character is complex. They end up being a very brilliant, good person, but they also have a sort of, you don't want to say devious, but they have an underbelly of anger, rage, deviance, something.
That somewhere in there.
That sets them apart. And that duality, I think, was interesting to Rory and me. Mm.
One of the things you wrote about in the Degas book that fascinated me was what it takes for an artist to make art. What are the conditions necessary for making art? Space, time, solitude, things like that. And you explore some of that with Kate Chopin as well.
Well, I think you have to be hungry. And Kate Chopin was hungry. Her husband died. She had 6 children, 5 boys, alone. She thought she was going to inherit some money from her mother, and she didn't. What could she do? Well, she found out she could write short stories, and she found out people were interested in them. Not stories about the Midwest, because no interest was there. Stories about New Orleans, because it was so exotic. So she was hungry, and she started to write. And the same thing with Edgar Degas. He started to paint one pastel after another. Although he was already accepted as sort of a middling painter, he began to paint like 2,000 pastels or something to get his father out of jail. Hunger! They needed money, and they were committed to find it through their art.
And I think something that we found a parallel with Kate Chopin is she published over 100 short stories in her lifetime. And, you know, again, surrounded by these children, these young adults, these teenagers who live with her, you know, trying to balance, I think, being a woman at the time and expectations. So when she sometimes talked about her writing, it was just like a flimsy, like a hobby. But the actuality was she was a genius. You know, she started writing when she was 10 years old. She was at the Academy of Sacred Heart, valedictorian, won all the honors, spoke German, French, and English, would translate French literature. So she was this brilliant mother writer. But when people asked her about her writing, she kind of just said, oh, sometimes I just sketch out something. But actuality, looking at the archives, we can see that she's crossed things out. She erased things. She rewrote. She broke things apart and rebuilt. So I think part of her genius was having the talent, knowing that Louisiana had a curiosity for her as an outsider here for 14 years, and also the love of home. I moved away from New Orleans when I was 18, but you know, I still come back once a year, twice a year, three times a year. There's something about New Orleans that's almost mystical that keeps drawing you back, this promise of home. And I think through her writing, though she had to leave when her husband died soon after, she kept coming back here. Physically, she visited, but even through her poetry and her writing, she kept bringing herself back here for some reason.
Well, describe some of the places she wrote about, because she's known for her portraits of several places.
I think that for us, at least for me, The Awakening is kind of the pivotal story.
Right.
It's like the it book. It's a short book.
Yeah.
And I think there is so much visually and orally. And Kate was very much of, she would hear it, she would smell it, she would see it, she would taste it, she would touch it. And if you read The Awakening, you can almost feel the sand at the beach. You can almost feel the water. You can almost be walking down Esplanade yourself and see that house. I mean, because if you've been in New Orleans, it sort of like brings it back. But more importantly than the where is the who. She always has these dynamic, lustful characters in the middle of this where that somehow can't quite connect, and that's the who.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I always think of Esplanade Avenue when I think of her, that walking.
Because that's it plays, huh?
And I always think of driving past her, the place that she lived on Louisiana Avenue, too. That's the other place I associate with her.
She went to Clucheville, this town.
Sure.
As you know, Kate Chopin came to New Orleans in, I guess it was 1870. You know, she was only like 19. And then her father-in-law immediately had the nerve to die on them. And her husband, who was French, had to go to France during hurricane season. It was August, on a boat with sails. So there she was, pregnant, supposed to be kept in the house of this place, you know, in New Orleans. So she really, the brave thing about her is that she went out. Mm-hmm. She walked out alone by herself. Was a town where you had to have a chaperone. She didn't care. And she would go down Esplanade. She would take the streetcar. She would find out what was going on around her. And it was because she said she felt women didn't grow because they couldn't see anything. And she was determined she would see. Now, in Clucheville, which I did have the gift of visiting before her house was mysteriously burned down and then her journals in Louisiana were mysteriously destroyed or disappeared, that was a scary experience because it's basically one street without a bend in the road and dust and like maybe 100 people.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that you could go from New Orleans to that, only a bankrupt person, a starving person again, would go there. But she wrote a lot about it after because it was a very sensual place. People making love in the grass, people riding, men riding bareback. I mean, it may have been uptight, but it also was a very sensual place.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that in all of her writing, this sort of masked sensuality, which makes it terribly interesting.
I think that what was curious for us, this is Rory sharing, mm-hmm. is, you know, we looked at her biographies. You know, many people, Dr. Emily Toth, Dr. Barbara Yule, you know, have written about Kate Chopin. But looking at, you know, her first biography and what remnants from her original diaries he quoted, we got a chance to kind of go with Kate on this journey. She talked about the confusing streetcar line. She talked about the oak trees. She talked about the animal hooves, you know, of the horses on the pavement. And I think that, you know, traveling through her experience, we got to kind of picture ourselves there and also realize how much of New Orleans is somewhat the same in the streets and then the houses and the Mississippi River, the food, but also how restricted she was, even in what she, you know, these rules that women couldn't even take a walk by themselves. Also, soon after she landed here, she inherited her brother's little sister, who was now an orphan, who had come down from the bayou. And so she was the chaperone of this 9-year-old little girl who was probably grieving both of her parents. And Kate is really trying to maybe lift up this girl and also maybe hide her own fear. And perhaps she hid her fear through exploring. And I think her defiance is something that a lot of people still admire. I know that I do, too. And visual artists at the time in France, you know, women weren't really allowed to be in these male schools painting with people like Degas. They had to get private instruction. And the fact that they weren't allowed to, you know, sit in a park alone and just watch people pass by or, you know, be in the room drawing the different models. It was that kind of restriction that perhaps created more of a determination to break through that in order to become accomplished artists.
And drives curiosity, too.
Yeah.
But one of the great resources I think we have in New Orleans is how much of the built environment for these folks still exists.
Right.
You can drive by and imagine yourself in that space. You know, you really can. And we're very lucky.
We're very fortunate. Mm-hmm. You can see it. Yeah. I think we have to point to the fact for both Edgar Degas and for Kate Chopin, they were both very well educated. They had the specialty. Edgar Degas' mother, who was from New Orleans, you know, her pictures at the Historic New Orleans, her portrait is at the Historic New Orleans collection, her only portrait. When she died, Edgar Degas was the oldest of 5 children. It threw his father into such despair that one of the things they would do, he would take Edgar Degas around Italy. He owned 2 banks, one in Italy, one in France, and they would look at works of art. And Edgar began to sketch. And he encouraged him to go to art school. He encouraged him. It's unheard of. In other words, he grew Edgar as a painter and believed in him. That was extraordinary for Edgar, because so Edgar painted 18 hours a day and drew 18 since he was a very, very small boy. So he had the edge and the gift. Mm-hmm. The same thing happened for Kate Chopin.
Right. And
you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I think so, too, because, again, this is my 3rd book writing with my mom, is that she says you can write from the inside or the outside.
Right.
And a part of our writing duo is that we write from both. So as a mother-daughter team living in New Orleans, growing up in New Orleans, we know what's authentic and a description of New Orleans. We know what it feels like to walk up the steps of a home, to look at these giant tall ceilings. We also know what the importance of closing the door to make sure the mosquitoes don't come in. We know both the beauty and the pain. And I think bringing that into the story of Kate Chopin, what it was like for her was really important too, because not all the writing that we had researched really captured that essence of life and death in New Orleans, because we're always on the cusp of celebration and also potential travesty. Yeah.
The same thing with her.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Rory O'Neill Schmidt and Rosary O'Neill, whose new book is Kate Chopin in New Orleans. One of the things that's so charming about this book is that it takes a lot of different forms. You know, there's a straightforward biographical part, there's poetry, there are dramatic scenes, there are interviews, there are lots of photographs. I mean, there are a lot of different styles of writing. I also noticed that you ask the reader a lot of questions, encouraging them to put themselves in Kate Chopin's position, which I think is kind of wonderfully confrontational. It's like, think about this.
What would you do?
Yeah.
Why was she going to Clutchyville again and again? Was this person, Albert, still there? Was he still around? I mean, who else would she be seeing when she was there? If she was staying at this house, what else was likely happening? So yeah, exactly. We want the viewer, the readers to be involved with us and to ask those questions, because sometimes when you read history, it's just presented as fact, and it's presented as something that's already done, and there's no sense of agency. But we want the readers to really experience, what would you do in June, you know, in New Orleans in 1872, postpartum with a 9-year-old? Would you stay inside, or would you want to take a break and get some fresh air and walk?
Yeah.
So yeah. Including them in our story, too.
So talk about that section of interviews with experts. I especially loved the section about fashion.
This is Rora. Yes.
I
love fashion. When I was a kid, I actually wanted to become a fashion designer and studied at the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York. But I think that, again, part of knowing Kate's lived experience was, what was it like for her to get dressed in the morning? You know, compared to now, where, you know, you go to the gym, you have yoga pants, you know, a t-shirt. They had layers upon layers of clothing. And, you know, talking to Hope Hanifin, the historian and the costume designer, talking to Linda Welters, too, the idea of what women were wearing and then the restrictiveness of it was really meaningful. Women weren't really supposed to even move their arms very much at all. Or, you know, if they had these hoop skirts, they had to be careful of a candle that they would light themselves on fire. They're wearing these corsets that cause miscarriages because they were so tight. So, I mean, the idea of, you know, how would you even lace your shoe if you're wearing it? What is a process? And then how do you move through that world wearing that clothing? That was exciting. And also the beauty of it, too.
No wonder so few of them wanted to take a walk. That's all I can say.
The heat, I think it was the heat difficult too. In New Orleans, because when you had these layers on, like you wore gloves everywhere, the stickiness of it, veils,
And you imagine Kate Chopin, who loved fashion. She was fashion forward for her time. She loved art. She loved beauty. When she was on her honeymoon in Europe, she was sending home clothing and lace and things. And then when her husband's business, the cotton factor, goes out of business and he's bankrupt and they have to move to the bayou, she still has all this exquisite clothing and she keeps wearing it in Clutchyville. And so that creates more of a scandal too. Like, who does this city person think that she is, coming to town wearing lavender, you know, riding bareback on a horse? How dare she? And she just is wearing it, you know, she just wants to dress and express herself at the time. So I think that was kind of, I think something we explored was part of her duality, is that she hated rules, but at the same time, she still conformed to some of the societal rules and expectations, too.
And women only had two or three outfits. That was so surprising to me, Susan, that, you know, they had like one dress that they got married in, and then they wore it for parties for the rest of the year. They didn't tell me. That's extraordinary to me. They had one morning dress, and then I think we had one evening dress, one afternoon dress, and that was it. So, I mean, obviously you had to launder your clothes some kind of way. You only had a bath once a week if you were lucky. So it was a completely different, perfume became very, very important, I guess. But it was a completely different experience than what we have.
Yeah.
And of course, if you had spent a lot of money on this wedding dress, or on this, you know, say going out to the opera dress, let's see, if you dropped, I don't know, a couple thousand, you're not going to just throw it out and buy something else, you know. I guess there were certain department stores that might have sold fabric. You might have had a seamstress make something, but it was an ordeal to have an outfit.
Yeah.
And once you had it, you pretty much kept it. So although she may have insulted her environment, we understand that you probably couldn't replace these objects because it would have been too expensive.
And one other thing to note about what she was wearing is she was in mourning a big time, a big of her life in New Orleans. So a few months before she was married in St. Louis to Oscar Chopin, his mother died. And then she came to New Orleans and then his father died. And there these periods of successive deaths that even if she's pregnant or in postpartum, she has to wear certain colors and the certain amount of months. And then what after? After, you know, when can gray be introduced, you know, and how I think rituals around the dead and mourning were really interesting for both of us.
When you take on a subject like this for several years and you live with them, you grow to love them. You have to, or you won't keep it up. So tell me what you specifically loved about her, and tell me where and when you felt closest to her in your research.
Well, I never take on anything that doesn't have a deep question for me, because you're trying to learn something.
Sure.
And you hope this person is so much better at this than I am. You know, how can I learn about being a better writer? How can I learn about being a better mother? Her children all lived with her. When she died, they all mourned forever. I don't think any of them got over it. How can I balance that life as a writer, a creative woman, with the life of being a mother and have it be so explosive? How can I have a salon at my house every week and invite the most intelligent people of my neighborhood to my house and have some interesting conversation? I mean, she did a lot of things that I admired that I would like to do that kind of kept her growing. She was always growing. How can I have the nerve to travel to New York and knock on the door of an editor and ask them to take my short stories when I don't even know them? I mean, she did many things that other people would have just run from because it took a lot of guts.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I admire most of all. And she smokes cigars and cigarettes because she said the only way she could get attention is if she smoked a cigar or a cigarette and people thought her what she had to say might be important.
I love those pictures of her with cigars.
Yes.
They're some of my favorites.
Yes. Just that she was just more evolved. And you think about the fact Kate Chopin lived when our great great grandmother might have lived. I mean, really? Before the bike? I mean, really?
Before the bike.
You couldn't even go out on a bike. Yeah.
What about you, Rory?
It helps to put things in perspective when I'm afraid about, you know, doing a speech for work, even nervous coming to our interview here today, that she overcame so much in her own lifetime, that some of the daily challenges are so small. Mm. I think what I learned from her was she was a strategic businesswoman. And she's just so brilliant. We even asked some scholars, should we write this book? Is it worth writing? And the response was, well, was Shakespeare still worth writing about? Yes, there's more to explore. And she was like a Shakespeare. And we're just so proud that she was from Louisiana. But when she was writing her short stories, she would have a spreadsheet. And this is still in the archive of what she wrote, what date, how many pages, where she submitted, and what the response was from the publication. And so she was able to publish so many because she was looking at local color stories, the newspapers that had a need and were interested in stories about Louisiana and the Bayou. And I think something else I learned from her is she pushed things too far. And she took a huge risk, and she was punished. She did face the consequences, but perhaps that courage was worth it all in the end, since 125 years later, we're still talking about her work. So I admire that about her.
And we're still talking about her kind of impressive approach to writing as a business. As a businesswoman,
yeah.
You know, that kind
amazing.
Of career, which is not, yeah, that wasn't that common then, I don't think.
No, I mean, most people write, I have a story to tell. But she says, you know, who's listening and what are they listening to hear? So
right.
It's completely opposite. You know, it's very wise, actually.
Mm-hmm. Well, don't you think she's one of those writers that every now and then we just need to dust off and look at again? You know,
right.
It's like every generation deserves a new look at Kate Chopin. In a
right.
way. Because let's face it, the movies haven't really caught up with her.
No.
You know,
we're going to write a great movie on her. We're waiting to do it. We got a draft ready to go.
Oh, yeah. But the end.
Yeah. Well, you know, you can always say it's a question. A lot of endings are questionable. You know, and sometimes heroes die. We think about Hamlet. He died. Yeah. Romeo and Juliet, they both died. Never was a story of greater woe than a story of Juliet and her Romeo. I mean, you can have a sad ending as long as the question is an interesting question. We're asking a very important question for women. And every one of her stories has a very important question for a woman.
We've been talking with Rory O'Neill Schmidt and Rosary O'Neill about their new book, Kate Chopin in New Orleans. Rosary, Rory, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Susan. Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Celebrate Independent Bookstore Day Saturday, April 27th at your favorite indie store. 7 participating bookstores, Octavia Books, Baldwin & Company, Blue Cypress Books, Community Book Center, Frenchman Art & Books, and Garden District Bookshop have gotten together for a citywide literary crawl with a chance at a grand prize of gift cards for those who visit and get their passport stamped at all 7 participating bookstores. This year, the Passport Challenge takes place over 2 weeks instead of just 1 day, and one lucky reader will win a gift card from each participating store. Readers have from Saturday, April 27th until Saturday, May 11th to visit all 7. Tubby and Coos is opening a spot inside the Good Shop at 1114 Josephine Street. The grand opening celebration is in conjunction with Independent Bookstore Day, Saturday, April 27th from 11 a.m. to 6. Events include a book signing from T.Q. Sims and Chris Clarkson, and pop-ups from local artist and author Alexis Bro, who co-wrote Carnival of Creatures with Candace Huber and Little Ghost Company. Leslie Hebert Elikoski signs When the Rain Came Down and Gator's Big Mouth, Saturday, April 27th at 11 a.m. at Octavia Books. T.Q. Sims discusses his novel Godspeed, Lovers, with journalist Tracy Ann Duncan, Tuesday, April 30th at 6:30 at Blue Cypress Books. And coming up, the Black Ink Book Festival returns for its second year, Saturday, May 11th, from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the City Park Pavilion of the Two Sisters. There will be 75 participating authors representing a diverse range of genres. Featured guests include Farah Roshan, Alex Jennings, Mona Lisa Saloy, and Kalamu Yasalam. Admission is free, but please pre-register with Eventbrite. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, with major support from Rouse's Markets. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.